Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And I'm there and nothing's happening. I'm thinking, fuck, man, nothing's happening. Nothing's happening. This is shit. And after about half an hour, suddenly, do you know what? I have to be so careful about talking about this because I'm getting a buzz talking about it. So let me bring it down a little bit because my head's going a little bit wobbly. Basically, I suddenly got very, very high. And voice in my head said, welcome home. Welcome home, son. What have you been doing? And for 20 minutes, it was fucking incredible.
I can't give enough gratitude to Ian Lee. He gives an honest and beautiful conversation in this. We speak about his career. We speak about his addiction and mental health. So let's get into this. This is Ian Lee on Scroobius Pips Distraction Pieces Network, brought to you by Acast in association with Elite UK. Here we go. Behind your barricade. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Ian Lee, he's a TV presenter, radio presenter, I'm a celebrity finalist and came third, and just a genuinely nice guy. I can't thank him enough for this conversation, and I know I say this every time, you're going to be bored of hearing it, but I genuinely think this might be one of my favourite conversations. So if you want to follow our work, please go to @ukleak.org, our Facebook, ukleak.org, our website, @ukleak on Twitter and Instagram. Thank you so much, and I'm not going to hang about. Let's get straight into this. This is Ian Lee.
That looks like it's going. So I genuinely can't believe that I'm with Ian Lee, because I've just said to you before you walked in, or just as you was walking in, is that I do feel like I've grown up with you from the age of 18 upwards.
Nuts and nut.
You've been with me in my
20
way.
Years ago, 21 years ago, I had what I guess you would call my break. The big break was doing, not big break, but doing the 11 o'clock show with, who was on there? Daisy Donovan, Ricky Gervais, Sasha, Mackenzie Crook, people like Charlie Brooker and Jimmy Carr and Robin Ince were writing on it. You know, loads of people.
It was just such a good show. And I genuinely don't think there's anything like it now. You've got satirical programs, but you were brilliantly sarcastic, and that doesn't mean it sounded back.
There was sarcasm, it mixed with just plain cruelty, to be honest. It was that late 90s, early 2000s thing, you know, the kind of FHM, tits out for the lads, let's bully. There's a lot of punching down instead of punching up. But, you know, I'm proud of it. I wouldn't watch it now because, you know, a lot of it I'm sure wouldn't stand up. And, you know, we did some terrible things on there. But I was a 24-year-old kid and I was skint and I was living at my mum's, and suddenly I got given a TV show to go and work with some of the funniest people in the world.
And then the other thing that I don't think I've ever publicly admitted, but I'm not a particular big reality TV fan.
Yeah, me neither.
But
I hate it.
You've done one that I do actually watch, and it is relevant to the discussion we're going to have about mental health and things like that, so I might as well kick off with it. But you've done I'm a Celebrity.
I did I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, to give it its full title in 2017. Not only did I do it, young man, I came third.
Which is amazing.
It was nuts. They'd asked me to do it loads of times, like maybe four times. And I'd always said no because my wife at the time didn't really want me to do it, and I can understand why. And also, I always thought it was a bit of a, you do it and you're saying, yeah, my career's over and I'm, you know, I can't get any work. And I was working, I was doing a lot of radio, but they kept asking me and I kept considering it and saying no. And thinking, well, that's quite a handy little check to have in the back pocket. And then in 2017... I split up with my wife and I moved out and I started doing the maths and realized I was never going to be able to afford to buy anywhere again. So I said to my agent, can you phone up, you know, I know this sounds desperate, but can you phone up ITV and see, this was in October, I think, October, and see if they'd like me to do I'm a Celebrity this year, because I think I might be up for doing it. And he did. He phoned them up. I had a meeting with them the next week. And then a couple of weeks later, I got the call saying they'd love you to do it. So I did it. I did it because I needed the money. You know, it pays quite well. I did it because I was on a, I'm on a radio station, talk radio, and they just didn't advertise. And I thought, well, this is a chance to, at some point in front of 12 million people, say, hey, I do a radio show. And the third reason was because my boys, who were 6 and 8 at the time, had never really... 6 and 8? Yeah. Had never really seen me on TV, apart from on Pointless and, you know, a couple of things like that. And I thought, well, they are old enough now to see me on a big primetime entertainment show being covered in spiders and fish guts and stuff, and they'll find it funny, you know, they'll enjoy it. So those were the three reasons, and I did it. It was the weirdest experience of my life, man.
I'm going to come up with the most pointless, stupid question ever, but
go on.
Is it as hard as it looks? Because it, to me, it just looks like hell.
Bits of it are harder. Bits of it are harder. Are bits of it easier? No, bits of it harder. I tell you, the hardest thing is it's so boring. You're in there and they warn you about it. When I got to it, because I was going in, it was me and Kezia Dugdale, Labour MP in Scotland, were going in as the second set of contestants. So we were going to go in 5 days later. So I got to Australia on a Monday and I wasn't going in until the Thursday of the next week. So nearly 2 weeks, week and a half, I'm in Australia. And as soon as I landed, they took my phone off me. They took my laptop off me. They checked me into a hotel that I was in quarantine in. I wasn't allowed to leave the hotel. And they got rid of the internet and the phone in the hotel room. I was in lockdown, so that I wouldn't know who else was going in. And my plan was, go in last. I did a lot of stuff for Big Brother, and I know how these things work. The people that go in last, you know, a few days in, always get booted out first because the audience doesn't bond with them. So my plan was, I'm going to go in last, get booted out first or second, it'd either be me or the other person, and then have a nice holiday, and you get paid the same. And it didn't work like that. Some reason, the public took a shine to me and I stayed in until the very last day. But your question was, is it as hard as it looks? It's harder. It's harder because it is boring. You can have 2 or 3 days of doing nothing, you know, so you'd be hoping you'd get a challenge. Some of the people I was in there with were assholes and I didn't like them. So it was very lonely for a lot of it. And the people that I did like found it easier to talk to me in those few moments we had when we weren't on camera. We had a few moments when we knew we weren't being filmed, and then they would kind of offer support, but they didn't want to do it in front of the cameras, which I totally get. And it is that thing of you go a bit nuts, you know, that thing, you know, you're in there and you get letters from home and you see these people that have been in jungle for 8 days and they get letters from home and they're in tears. And I got sucked into that. Everything gets amplified and magnified and they mess with your mind in there. You don't know what time it is. You're not allowed watches. One of the games that we would have is when we went off site to do a trial is trying to look at people's watches, and everyone's watches were covered with tape, but you would try and come up with cheats. This is how messed up it was, right? So no one ever came into the camp apart from a few times to set up props. But when you went off to do a trial, it was quite a long journey to the area where the trial was. And you would walk with a film crew who weren't allowed to talk to you. So you'd walk for about 20, 25 minutes. Then you'd get into the back of a blacked out Jeep and drive for like 15 minutes. Then you'd come out of the Jeep and you'd have to have towels over your head, like your hostages, towels over your head, look at the floor and have your hand on someone in front of you so you couldn't see where you were. Then you get put in a tent and they'd say, right, you can take your towels off now. So it was all mind games, man. It was all mind games.
And you were open about your mental health in there. And as you said, everything is going to be amplified. Absolutely. Why wouldn't it be?
Yeah.
You know, you're in a complete microcosm or something.
Yeah.
But you were open on camera about the mental health difficulties you had in your life, but also within the jungle as well.
I was open about some of them. I didn't mention the drugs. didn't mention drugs on camera. I mentioned it to people off camera. I didn't mention it on camera. We didn't get much time off camera. We had little bits, but not a lot. So I didn't mention that because some members of my family, you know, even though at that point I was 13 years clean, some members of my family still didn't know. And I thought this is not a fair way for them to find out. But the mental health stuff, yeah, you know, I don't remember what I talked about. And I've not watched it back. So I don't know exactly what they showed. I mean, I think the thing that a lot of people identified with was on my first trial. This was like my second trial, second day in. It was a swimming one, and you get a form and it says, can you swim? And I wrote, yeah, because I can swim, but I can't swim that well. And I certainly can't swim underwater. And my first trial was I had to go 3 meters underwater and swim through these tunnels. And oh God, it was awful. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. And it was such, there was such a build up of, you know, the weeks leading up to it, where you get measured for your costumes, then the flight out there, and then the 12 days I had in a hotel room, and then you go in and it's this adrenaline rush, and oh, I'm in the jungle, and then your first trial, yeah, okay, I'm gonna do it. And I couldn't get one star. I failed it miserably, and I just kind of came crashing down. And I came back to the camp, and everyone had this really annoying thing which I knew was going to backfire. Well, they come back to the camp after trying to go, oh, I failed it. And everyone go, oh no, only kidding, I got 8 stars. And I saw that, I thought, that is going to bite someone on the arse at some point. Yeah. And it was me. I came back and I said, failed it. Come on, Ian, what did you get? I said, no, I failed it. Come on, man. And I burst into tears. And I think that's the thing that everyone bought into. People mentioned it certainly to me afterwards, and I saw it on like my best bits. It was me there, stood there crying, and it was a combination of come crashing down from the adrenaline, the humiliation of, you know, not being able to do that trial, knowing that it was going to be seen by millions of people, and the humiliation of coming back empty-handed and knowing everyone was going to go hungry that night. And I just burst into tears. Also, I, like, you know, cry quite a bit. And I think some people at home respected that. Some didn't, you know. Some called me a twat and all of that. And I know some of the people in the camp saw it as a sign of weakness. But I'm quite comfortable with. I love a good cry, man.
Yeah, in this day and age, we certainly don't think of it in terms of weakness, do we? But are you aware we've?
We don't think of it, but some people do. Quite a lot of people do. I mean, I still got flack the other day on Facebook about something, and someone went, oh, you're the pussy that cried on I'm a Celebrity, aren't you? And I said, no, I'm not. I'm the guy that showed a different side to masculinity. But, you know, some people still see it as being a bit puffy, a bit gay, you know.
Perhaps, again, it's the circles that we're in at the moment. We're in releases offices, which is a outreach because of people who've got mental health and drug addiction. And I've just, for the last 10 years, I've assumed that everybody's having this conversation, that actually emotion's fine. Yeah, we need that.
They're not. There are still a lot of old-fashioned men and a lot of old-fashioned women. There are a lot of old-fashioned people who think that you should suck it up. But here's the thing. I don't give a stuff about those people. When I came out of the jungle and I got given my phone back, and I had something like 1,500...
Wow.
Twitter messages and emails. I had a public email address then. I had a few hundred emails, and I read as much as I could. I didn't reply to all of them, but the majority of them were congratulating me. And I talked in there about social anxiety, about how I don't like groups. I get uncomfortable in groups and conversation. I'm struggling to make eye contact with you because I don't really like it. And I had so many people. I mean, the one that sticks in my mind is a mum wrote to me and said, Ian, I was watching you with my 14-year-old son, and he started crying when he saw you, and he turned to me and he said, Mum, that's me. And she said, I just want to say thank you. And that is one specific email. And I had a lot that were very similar in tone. I also had emails from wives who, I had a few. I mean, this shows you what the problem is. Couple from wives whose husbands had killed themselves, a couple from parents whose sons primarily had killed themselves. because they suffered from depression and anxiety and fear of, you know, being themselves. And you know, they sent these very emotional emails saying, I wish, you know, my son had been able to talk like you, you know. So there was a lot of that.
What is that like? Because you, because where you're a public figure on the radio and you deal with a lot of problems on talk radio, and you do, you get a lot of people coming your way, both on calls but also outreach on social media and emails, and you are inundated with a lot of people's problems. Mm. What is that like?
It's overwhelming. It's overwhelming. And for quite a while, I tried to fix everybody that came to me, and I would reply to everybody that came to me. And I perhaps got too personally involved, and it was making me sick, you know, literally making me sick. So I had to make a conscious decision to kind of take a step back, to not feel bad if I don't reply to emails. I don't have a public email address anymore because of that and because of a couple of other things, but I had to take a step back, really, and to protect myself. It's slightly different on the show, because if someone phones up, I'm also wary about having conversations in private with people in case something is misconstrued. On the radio, I've got Catherine, my co-host, there, and we have an audience of listeners, and I'm very happy to share my experience with drugs. We get a lot of people who've got addiction problems phoning in. I'm happy to share my story about, you know, I've called the Samaritans before now when I've been feeling suicidal. I'm happy to share that in kind of a public forum, but I tend, you know, if someone writes, gets in touch with me and says, I'm going to kill myself now, I give them the Samaritan's number and say, call these people now and see how you feel in half an hour. And it might sound a bit cold, but I found, we had a guy, right, before Christmas on the radio show, a guy called Chris, who phoned up and he'd taken an overdose and he was dying. And first, listen to the call, the first couple of minutes, we're taking the mickey out of him because he just sounded a little bit drunk. Not taking, we're having a laugh with him because he sounded a little bit drunk and he was on speakerphone, and I hate speakerphone. But as soon as me and Catherine clicked that he was serious and he was in a really bad way, we kind of went into panic mode, and Catherine left the studio and phoned 999, and I'm trying to find out what this guy's taken, how much this guy's taken, and where he is. And he didn't know where he was. He was out in the street in Plymouth. And I'm going, right, what can you see? What can you do? And we worked out. And then people listening phoned up and said, right, it sounds like he's here. And we kind of worked out where he was. And he was dying, man. He's, you know, he was slurring and it was getting his voice. And I had to just talk to him for half an hour. And there were 10 minutes when he stopped talking. I thought, shit, he's dead. And then he came back, and then after half an hour, the ambulance was the police. The police picked up the phone and said, thanks very much, sir. We've got him now. We'll take control of this. And I burst into tears. I burst into tears, man. And we kept it on air because I didn't want to waste a second of me going, I'm just going to go and take this off air. Because that's 15 seconds could have gone. And I tried to fix him after that. I found out that I had his number, so I texted him. He did go to intensive care. He was intensive care for a few days. He died. They brought him back to life. And then Christmas Day it was, or Boxing Day, because I had the kids. He phoned me up, this guy, and I'm there trying to fix him on Boxing Day, and I've only just got my kids. And I'm trying to find a hotel for him to stay in. La, 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 la. And I'm phoning up AA to help him. And then after about 40 minutes, I realized he didn't actually want my help. I'm giving him all these options. I was telling him what he should do. And he didn't want to know. He wanted to moan at me about his situation, which was a shitty situation. And it suddenly dawned on me what I'd been told before in recovery. You can't fix him. If he didn't want it, he didn't want it. And I said, all right, listen, I'm going to have to go. Here's the number for AA. Here's the number for the Samaritans. I'm going to go because I'm going to be with my kids now. And we had a little bit more contact, and it got a little bit tense, shall we say, a couple of times. And I was able to let it go because I'd done my bit. And the papers wanted me to go do interviews, and I turned down interviews with, you know, that wanted... I did a few interviews, but not any that wanted to exploit him. Good Morning Britain wanted me to go on with him, and I said, I'm not going to ask a guy who's just tried to kill himself to come on a live TV show. You nuts? But that was the point where I really realised I can't fix everyone. I can't fix everyone. I can give people the tool. I can help show people the tools. I'm rambling a bit. I can show people the tools, but I can't fix them if they don't want it. And I don't think... I don't want to speak for him. I don't know what he wanted. But I've just had to take a step back is the really long answer to whatever that question was. I've forgotten. Sorry.
Perfectly eloquent. I think that's genuinely such an intriguing answer, because part of me wonders, the people come to you because you are out there a public figure and have got experience within these fields and have been vocal about it. Is that why people come to you?
Yeah, they do. They do. And I kind of, if I'm completely honest, my ego bought into it a little bit as well. My ego, you know, this saving this guy, help talking to this guy on the phone. Look, there I go again, saving this guy's life. I didn't, the police did. Talking to this guy on the phone got onto the front page of the Star. Front page, the Star. It was in all the papers. And I allowed myself to, my ego to buy into that, that I'm a great man. I saved a guy's life. I saved a guy's life. I can do great things. And I do think that radio can do great things. And we've helped a lot of people on the radio show. But I think some of it was my ego wanting to feel flattered. But yeah, we do get people calling in that want help. And I've had to make a conscious step back because I think the show was suffering. You know, the show is a lighthearted, funny, stupid, dumb, silly show. Tonight we're going to be getting people to phone in and sing the lyrics that they sing when there are TV theme tunes playing. But suddenly the whole show was becoming a little bit like a Samaritans, which was not great for a lot of the listeners. I don't think it was helpful to the people that were calling in, and it was damaging to me. It was damaging my mental health, actually. I was feeling a weight of responsibility that actually wasn't my responsibility. So we kind of, Catherine and I, made a decision to let it go a bit. People can still phone up with their issues, and we'll talk about them because I think it's important, and I'll talk about my stuff, but we've taken a little step, a couple of steps back.
And this is how you're here with me now, because how did it work? So originally...
Because you've been flirting with me for a while about me coming on, and I said, yeah, I want to do it, but I don't want to do it now, whenever you first asked. And I'm also shit at getting back at emails, and we've been planning this for ages and ages, and it's finally happened. But I don't remember when you first made contact,
I thought you'd be
older as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See, I don't know if that's a good thing or bad.
Oh, it's a good thing. You're a young man.
I'm going grey and yeah.
Shut up. Look at that beautiful hair.
Oh, it's receding. I bumped my head this week. I was out with a walkman with Dad, and I've got kind of a minor concussion because it was this big branch.
Wow.
But, yeah, I digress.
Oh, I can see a little thing under there.
Stupid bloody... I'm at that age where I'm walking into things. That's how old I am.
It's all downhill from there.
But how did it work? So you've done Stew's Off the Beaten Track. You know Scroobius Pip?
Yep. Well, very, very loosely, yes. I've been privileged to meet him a couple of times, yeah.
And then when Rufus Hound covered for you one evening, it come up about drugs.
Yeah.
And then one of our guys from Leap, I think it was Andy Michon, went on with him.
Right.
Then, how did it work? Then I came on your show on the phone one evening as I was doing my toenails, bizarrely enough. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know why.
Always
that's
good
relevant.
To do toenails.
Which,
overlooked.
Bizarrely, I did them last night. So there must be something about you.
Toenail collection. I like
yes,
it.
Yes, you can have that on your Twitter bio.
There we go. Yeah.
And then from there, you said, "Yeah, I'll do the podcast." And then I think you know Secret Drug Addict as well.
Yeah. And
then,
the show a bit.
And then, yeah. So that's kind of how the weird merging of how this happened.
So you can I ask you a question?
Yeah, go for
you,
it.
Are you one of us? Are you in the club? Are you a junkie?
Not quite. I have got a weird story, which is kind of out there, but I try not to really sort of kind of talk about it, but I might as well.
Well, you don't have to say anything.
No, that's fine. It's just like, I'm kind of like you, where it's like, look, I don't like talking about myself.
Yeah.
Because I get that impression with you. It's like, you know, you're a public figure and you're always out there and you're having to speak about yourself, but you're very self-deprecating when you do it.
There's a lot of stuff I don't... I'm very open about, you know, my sexuality and my drugs and my depression, but no one knows the names of my kids, you know. I talk about my kids, but no one knows the names of them. Never speak about details about my marriage. You know, there are stuff that is very, very private. But yeah.
So my way into this is that I've been housebound disabled since the age of 8.
Okay.
I've had an illness which creates constant pain. So I was prescribed codeine from the age of 8.
Wow.
I had a terrible doctor. Absolutely appalling. So when you're on a high dose of codeine from that age, you know, where do you go from there? So I got to 25 and I realised I need to do something about this. I can't, you know, my organs aren't going to take it. So someone said, if you try cannabis, I said, no, all drugs are bad. You know, I'm from that generation of just say no. Plus my prescription drug legacy is weird. Like I've had eye drops that have turned me blind and so I don't react well. And then I tried cannabis and it had a really good effect on me.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm here now, because without that, I know I'm going to be in an immense amount of pain when I get back.
Yeah.
And I need to get myself out of that. So I've got this kind of regime of relaxation periods.
Okay.
So that's how I'm here. So I've got what I like to think is an understanding of addiction because of how the very, very complex relationship I've got with codeine, because it's, you know, it is an addictive drug.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah.
And I've certainly experienced times where, I wouldn't say addiction, but I can certainly see problematic behaviours of, oh, just take two more.
Yeah.
And then the tolerance builds up, and then where do you go from there? So cannabis gave me a way of getting out of that, of making sure that I can cap my code. I'm still on it, but it's very low levels now. So that's why I think I've got an empathy with people that have gone through addiction, because I can understand it's not about the drug. It's about everything that's going on in your life at that time.
The drug's the thing. I should apologise. Some people might be upset at me saying junkie. I know some people...
But you can own it.
I can own it. I am. I was. I am. I always will be. But I know there might be some people going, what are you talking about, junkie? But so, you know, some people might be upset by that. So I take that back to a certain extent. But for me, being an addict is not, you know, it's not about the drugs, you know. For me, it was drugs, it was sex. I've had an argument with someone today, so I'm trying to lose weight, but I just stopped off at a service station and bought a massive coffee and a huge bar of chocolate. In the great scheme of things, it's not a lot, but I didn't want either of those things, and they made me feel bad afterwards. It's the same thing, food, sex, buying stuff on eBay. I had a great chat on my radio show. We said this on air, so I can say it, with... Chris Difford from Squeeze, who is, you know, famous. You read his autobiography, guys. He talks about addiction and drug addiction and stuff. And we were having a really honest chat. And I said, I've got so much crap that I've bought from Amazon and eBay still in their boxes in the boot of my car. And he went, I used to do that. He said, I would buy this stuff to make me feel better. It would arrive. I couldn't show the wife that I bought all this stuff. So I just put it in the boot of the car and it would be full with these boxes of things I didn't want. But the buying of them was an obsession and it made me feel better. And then when they arrived, I felt shit again. So for me, the addiction can be anything. And it was trying to mask. What was it trying to mask? It's trying to mask... loneliness, self-loathing, you know, what happened to me, stuff that happened to me as a kid, confusion about my sexuality. It was trying to mask all of that and it was trying to push all that down. And when I take drugs and when I have, you know, sex outside of a relationship, you know, or stuff my face full of food, there is a moment when I'm taken out of myself and I don't give a shit that I hate myself. But of course, the cycle then is, second later or half an hour later or a day later, I feel shit and I hate myself again. So I've got to go and do the same thing, but a little bit more. I've got to watch more extreme porn. I've got to buy something more expensive from eBay, you know. So the drugs weren't the... I mean, and also, let's be honest, For a while, I had an amazing time on drugs. I had an amazing time on drugs. For a while, the drugs worked, you know. The drugs made me confident. They made me sexy. They made me funny. They made things funny. They gave me energy. They allowed me to, you know, to have sex confidently. They, you know, LSD, I've never laughed so much. But that was like, you know, a tiny part of my drug use. You know, that was a small part of my drug use. And then the rest of it, I'm doing a small sign here and then a big sign. The rest of it was miserable, you know, and was degrading and humiliating and put my life at risk and lost me friends and relationships and work and money and made me suicidal and nearly killed me, you know. So, but I have to acknowledge that for a bit of it, the drugs were wicked, you know. That's the truth.
I'm very conscious about the gift that I bought you now as well.
Drugs. Food.
Sitting food. Next to Ian, there is two packets of what we call Polish wafer chews, which are these wafers filled with a cream. And they are, all the Distraction Pieces Network guys are on them now. Yeah. They are so stupidly addictive.
I always find it funny when you go to NA meetings and, you know, there's a tea person there who makes tea and coffee and brings biscuits. And some of them, you'll go into the meetings and there'll be like a plate of donuts and a plate of Kit Kats and and you think, fucking hell, man. You know, a lot of the people in this room have got issues with food as well. You know, it seems a strange thing. But then that person's issue is helping, you know, it's a confusing network. I'd never judge anybody.
The food issue is always something that really intrigues me because I've got someone close in my life that's got food addiction. Yeah. And it is, I would say that food addiction is probably up there with one of the hardest things to deal with because you can't be abstinent from it. And it's
everywhere.
Yeah, and we had Marcus Brigstock as well on who had this discussion as well that he knew that his low points were when he was eating his kids' meals out of the bin.
Yeah,
you know,
wow.
These are the things that he opened up about. And it is true that food seems to be filling a gap for a lot of people, especially when they're tapering off of certain drugs as well. So have you experienced this as well with food?
With food, I mean, I mean, there's nothing... I would say mine is tamer than a lot of other people. You know, there's certainly no bulimic kind of vibe to it. There's no throwing up. There's none of that. But yeah, if I feel shit, I will eat a load of food. You know, I will eat half a tub of ice cream. I'll eat two or three tubs of Pringles. Again, in the great scheme of things, people be going, what? You eat three tubs of Pringles. But I'm not wanting to do it. It is out of my control. I will make myself bloated. I will make myself feel sick, and I will look in the mirror and be disgusted at, you know, my fat belly as I perceive it. You know, and I'll vow not to do it again, and I'll either do it, you know, an hour later or I'll do it the next day. It is out of my control, and it is coming from the same place for me as drugs. I'd rather be shoveling food into me than cocaine. Actually, I'd rather be doing neither of those things. I'd rather be in a confident, self-loving place where I don't need to do something to stop me feeling. It's to stop me feeling. I mean, the big one for me was sex, you know, porn and relationships, you know, sexual encounters outside of a loving relationship and all these kind of things. It's that thing of just not being comfortable with who I am, not liking who I am, and wanting to drown it out. The food one is a big one, though, and I think that I've been in meetings, NA meetings, where someone has gone, I was in an AA meeting in New York last year, and a woman, I always feel a bit weird in AA meetings. NA is kind of my place, but I go to AA if there's nothing else. And a woman said, well, I've been free from sugar for 2 weeks. And people laughed. People laughed. And I went up to her afterwards and just said, I just want to say thank you for what you shared about the sugar. You know, I struggle with it, not in the same way as you, but I struggle with food. And it was really impressive to hear you've gone 2 weeks. Well done. Because people laugh about, even in meetings, people will laugh about stuff that to them, you know, there are some people that are addicted to wanking, you know, addicted to wanking. And I've heard people laugh about that. And you think, but if it's causing them shame and if it's out of their control, then that's the same thing as me shoveling coke up my nose or you, not you, but, you know, another person, that's you not being able to stop drinking vodka, you know, or... It's the same thing, man. Yeah. May not kill them, might do, but it's the same thing And that always has me scratching my head a little bit in meetings.
And I think self-harm as well. With people that take a blade to their skin, it's the same principle. With it's self-soothing in one way or another. So you still attend regular meetings, do you?
He hesitates. Yeah, I could always do more. I got 13 years clean. Then when I came back from the jungle, after a whole culmination of things, including not going to NA meetings for about 18 months, maybe 2 years, I picked up drugs again. I put myself in a situation where I knew there was going to be, crystal meth. I'd never done crystal before. I knew there was going to be crystal. And I thought, if it gets offered to me, I'm going to have a go because I think I'm all right. Of course I wasn't all right. I was fucking insane, man. I was insane. I'd done this, this surreal, intense experience in Australia, 10 days in isolation, 3 weeks, being bullied by people, then coming back to being more famous than I'd ever been in my life. It's worn off now, but I couldn't walk down the street without a dozen, 12-year-olds, 10-year-olds coming up to me asking me for selfies. It was insane. So that, combined with the fact I hadn't done meetings, combined with the fact I'd been living in a bedsit for a year, and I'd had to pretend that my marriage was still successful, all of those things meant I was not very well, and my resistance was low. And so I put myself in a situation where there was drugs, and I did crystal meth for the first time. I'm there, I'm sucking on a pipe. I've never sucked on a pipe in my life. And I'm there and nothing's happening. I'm thinking, fuck, man, nothing's happening. Nothing's happening. This is shit. And after about half an hour, suddenly, do you know what? I have to be so careful about talking about this because I'm getting a buzz talking about it. So let me bring it down a little bit because my head's going a little bit wobbly. Basically, I suddenly got very, very high. And a voice in my head said, welcome home. Welcome home, son. What have you been doing? And for 20 minutes, it was fucking incredible. 20 minutes, I was so fucking high, man. I was watching porn, thinking, this is it. I'm back. And then for the next 36 hours, it was horrendous. I was trying to capture that first hit again, and I couldn't. And it was awful. It was awful. And, I picked up, not even where I left off, I picked up worse than where I left off. And I was well enough that when I got home, tried to sleep it off, couldn't. I told my best friend, phoned up some people in NA that I hadn't spoken to for years and grassed myself up. And that was my pattern for the next 3 months, was acting out, picking up drugs, using drugs, cocaine I went back to. Feeling the shame and the guilt. Telling my best friend, going to meetings, 3 months of that before it clicked again. Before it clicked and I finally managed to get it. Finally managed to get recovery and get clean. And now I'm 15 months clean. And the obsession to use is gone again. And I'm lucky it was only 3 months, I was lucky it was only 3 months. I'm lucky that I had a job that was important to me. I'm lucky that I had a really good friend who was important to me and didn't judge me. And I'm lucky I got back into the swing of recovery again. So, yeah, I do go to meetings. I've got a sponsor who I don't phone often enough. Usual. I could go to more meetings. I could speak to my sponsor a bit more. But while I regret having a 3 month relapse, I'm also glad I had a 3 month relapse because it showed me there was some lingering doubts. Maybe I wasn't an addict. Maybe I just got a bit crazy. I'm a fucking addict, man. I've got no control. Once that drug hits me, boom, I'm gone. I'm out of here. Fuck you. Fuck my kids. Fuck everyone. Fuck them. You're not important.
You've spoken really openly about NA and AA and 12 steps.
Yeah.
And this is quite often the discussion we have in drug policy reform generally is abstinence definitely works for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily work for everybody because of various different life situations, and hence why we recommend heroin-assisted treatment, and which is kind of like a methadone program with heroin and things like that. But for you personally, is abstinence the way that you've had to deal with it?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I don't see the point in having a beer. Why would you want a beer? You want 12 beers, right? Why would you have a glass of wine? You want 3 bottles of wine, right? Right? Don't see the point in a beer. I couldn't have a spliff. I couldn't, because, you know, when I got that high from that crystal, just doors opened in my head, and I was back in this kingdom of, let's get fucked. And that would be the same thing with all of those things. And I know people that, drop some names. I was doing a thing with Kelsey Grammer.
Oh, wow.
Frasier. I was hosting an evening with Kelsey Grammer Theatre, and I got to go and have a coffee with him a couple of weeks before. Of course, he's famously talked openly about being a cocaine addict. And I was talking about, I said to him, what can't I talk about? What can't I? He said, can you ask me anything? I said, can we talk about drugs? He said, yeah. I said, okay. I was talking about it now because I'm a cocaine addict. I know that you were, but I noticed that you were having a martini. How does that work? And he said, well, the drugs were a problem and I went into rehab and it stopped for a bit. And then I came back and I did the drugs and I started, but eventually got clean. I don't know how many years he's clean now. It's quite a while. And he said, and I did AA. And then a few years ago, I thought, I think I'm okay. And I don't know how many years ago, 5, 6, 7, 8, something like that. And he drinks now. And he can drink, it would appear, and I believe him, he can drink in moderation. You know, he can have a martini. Certainly wasn't drunk the night, but, you know, it would appear he has that under control. And for him, that works. For him, that works. I know people that can have a little smoke now after years of being clean. Beautiful. I'm envious, deeply envious. I'd love a joint. Love it. But I can't do it because I would smoke that eighth in an evening and I'd be trying to score some more. Oh, by the way, if you're coming round and you've got some gear, you haven't got any, you don't know where I could get some coke. I'm fucked.
Yeah. So have you got two different versions of you, the one that's got the addiction head and then there's the you that's got the rational head, or is it, does it all merge into one?
It's
picture?
All kind of mixed up it's all kind of mixed up in there. It's like when I was talking then about my relapse, I actually started to get a little buzz off it. I can feel my breath getting a little bit shorter because it was exciting me. It was exciting me, and I have to be aware of that. No, it's all a mess. This abstinence works for me. I'm aware it's not for everyone. That's great. I'm aware that for a long time I would get really annoyed when people would say that the 12 steps weren't for them. Fuck you talking about, man. This shit fucking works. This shit fucking works for me, and it works for a lot of people I see, but it's not for everyone. I get that now. I get that it's not for... If you're not coming to a meeting just because of the God line, then I would ask you to reconsider and explain. In fact, I was just talking to someone on Twitter. We were talking about OA, and he said he didn't like it because of the God stuff. And I said, well, you know, the way it was explained to me, maybe they shouldn't write God with a capital G. Maybe it should be a lowercase g. In fact, I think it definitely should be. I know it comes from a Christian principle, but let's make it a lowercase g. Let's even take God out and put higher power. You know, for me, my God is... It's sunshine, it's a tree, it's the forest, it's my kids laughing. That's my higher power, is the universe, you know, Mother Nature, whatever you want to call it. And I think that maybe a significant number, I'm just guessing here, if you think differently, dear listener, then that's great. My opinion is I think maybe some people have come in once, seen the God thing and never come back, that could actually benefit from it. I think we might have lost a few people in terms of attendees because of that God thing. Okay. But I get that now the A meetings, the 12-step meetings, they're not for everyone. And there are other ways around it. You know, I know people that got clean through Jesus Christ, you know, through religion. Beautiful. If that works for you, man, I'm never going to knock you for doing it. I'm never going to knock you for doing it. There are people that have just stopped through their own sheer will. There are people that, you know, go to group therapy or go to treatment centres that aren't 12-step based. There are people that can cut back. If that works for you, then that's fantastic.
I think definitely the approach has to be as nuanced as the individual. Because, yeah. You know, we know people that have turned to extreme sports and that's gotten through. Which again, yeah, it's got its own issues with adrenaline rush.
I could never do... I saw so many people when I started getting clean that were losing weight and going to the gym. I never got that. I really tried to get addicted to that and I couldn't do it. It didn't work for me. You know, exercise doesn't work for me as a thing, but some people, they can. And you know, maybe you have to question, you talk about extreme sports and pushing yourself physically to the limit. Is, you know, how healthy is that? Well, it's healthier than putting a needle in your arm, you know. So there's kind of ups and downs of all it. But whatever works for you is good. You know, I used to be quite adamant that the 12 steps were the only way to go. And it's still, when people come to me on the show, it's still kind of my first suggestion to them, because it is what worked for me. And I can only really suggest, I can honestly suggest the stuff that's worked for me. But I get that it's not.
So
for everyone.
Can I ask, at what point did you think, actually, I might need to make some changes now?
I was doing a TV show 15 years ago called Rise that was like the Big Breakfast, but not as good. And it was a great show. I loved it. And suddenly I was earning more money than I'd ever earned in my life. And someone had given me the number of a dealer that would come round on a scooter. And I was, I don't remember what the point was. I was in a lot of pain. I mean, my drug use before then had been big. And that was that year when I thought, I need to cut down. I need to cut down. I mean, I was doing a lot of drugs. It sounds like I'm bragging. I'm not. I'm just being honest. I don't remember a point. I remember a point when I told my girlfriend at the time that I had a drug problem. And that was only because she caught me. I'd been late coming back because I was just in my car using. Jeez, glamorous. I was, all these messages, where are you? You're supposed to be home 4 hours ago. Fuck, and I was high as a kite. And I went back and said, I think I've got a drug problem. I only said it to get her off my back, to buy more time, you know, so that it would explain me using. And she had a friend who was an alcoholic, and so she kind of put me in. She said, you've got to stop this. You've got to phone up NA. And I phoned up NA to, you know, to show that I was doing something, but I had no intention of stopping. But that was, I mean, I knew before then I was fucked. You know when you got the house to yourself for 4 days and you just done coke, you know, the second your partner's gone out and you're just doing drugs and watching porn, you know, by day three of that, you think, fuck, is this, am I really? I used to think I was like a brave crusader. I used to think I was like a soldier pushing back the boundaries. It's the thoughts I had, pushing back the boundaries and frontiers of decadent hedonism and stuff. No, man, I was an idiot in a room with curtains nailed up to the window watching porn for 3 days in a row. Say it out loud. It doesn't sound very glamorous. I don't know when I realised, but that's when I started going to NA. And it took 16 months of going before I realised I couldn't cut down. I couldn't do it. I had to stop. And I had to stop everything. And so it was September 2014, I guess it was, 2013 or 2014, September the 27th was my last use up. And it was, you know, it was awful, it was horrendous. And then I got clean, and then I went, you know, really took the meeting seriously. And I do it all slowly. I didn't get a sponsor for ages, then I didn't start doing the steps for ages, and you know, but that's my journey.
A lot of people just take the mickey out of the entertainment industry because it's like, oh, you know, prima donnas using drugs, you know, poor them. Yeah. But you can totally see why, not necessarily the traps are there, but certainly the roots of why these issues start to creep in.
I think a lot of people in the entertainment industry have got very low self-esteem anyway.
Yeah. It's fragile, isn't it?
It's very fragile. There's a lot of low self-esteem. There is a lot of it. I don't know so much now because I've not really been in TV for a while, but there was in the early 2000s, you know, you could say to someone discreetly, do you know where I can get any coke, dear? And they say, oh, yeah, I'll get you some for tonight. There was a lot of that going on. You know, for me, suddenly I had money when I've been signing on. But then I think it's the same in any industry. I see a lot of black cabbies in NA meetings. You know, I don't know why that is. I see a lot of... It's everywhere. This is the thing, you know. I've been in meetings and I've been sat next to one of the biggest rock stars in the world. And I've, on the other side, I've had a homeless guy. Literally. It's literally been that. And it can that's the humbling thing, is that it can affect anybody. It can affect anybody. Is it more prevalent in show business? I don't know if it is, actually. I just think maybe we hear about it more than you hear about, you know, you hear more about pop stars that are cokeheads than you do window cleaners, because it was a more interesting story, apparently. I don't personally think it is at all.
Or we could use politicians as an example at the moment.
Politicians, yeah, you know, it's everywhere. It's everywhere, you know. So I don't know if it affects show business people more. I don't know.
It's going to kind of goes with the hospitality aspect of the industry. Again, I've got no knowledge of the industry. You know, I've always been very stepped back from it. But it seems like from the small amount I've seen through that little gap in the curtain, it does seem like, as you said, there's a lot of fragile egos. Mm. If you need to be out there and face being present, and when you're not, and you're not getting that attention all of a sudden, it must be difficult to kind of get your head around that.
I don't know. I mean, that is the thing. I don't know if I buy that thing. You know, you hear people saying, well, you know, rock stars or comedians, they do a tour for 25 nights and every night they're met by 2,000, 5,000, 20,000 fans, and then they come off, and how do you keep that high up? I don't know if I actually buy that so much. Maybe it's true in some cases. I mean, there is a lot of boredom, you know, it's something to do, but for me it was just because I felt like a piece of shit. I felt less than, and I felt bitter, a lot of bitterness. You know, we talk about the 11 o'clock show and how it set a lot of people off on careers. I was so jealous of Ricky Gervais and Sacha Baron Cohen and Mackenzie Crook as well, who I, you know, used to live with. I was jealous because after the 11 o'clock show, I had a couple of things, but not much. And suddenly Gervais and Sasha are in America making movies. And I'm thinking, well, that was supposed to be my career.
Because you were the anchor, weren't you? You were the main face.
He said anchor, just in case you're wondering. Yeah, that was always my career, was to do a couple of TV shows in Britain, then go to America and make movies. That was the dream I'd always had. Suddenly these two are doing it. Mackenzie's getting his own series. Now, of course, what I can see now is that Gervais and Sasha, Mackenzie to a certain extent, actually, he's shown in the past few years, but those two were very rare talents. You know, they happened to have been at one point, I don't know so much now, but they happened to have been two of the funniest people in the world who just so happened were on the same show that I was on. What are the chances of that? Very slim. But, you know, whatever you think of them now, they were two of the funniest people. That's why they went to... They were also very determined and very focused and very clean. But that's why they ended up in Hollywood making movies, being multimillionaires. But for a long time, I'm sat at home watching these fuckers on my telly fucking going off and having my career. The fucking... You know, and I'm sat there... Of course, it's not going to happen to me. I'm sat there snorting coke and... But just railing against how unfair the universe is. Instead of looking at the wonderful things I've been given, I'm consumed with bitterness and jealousy and resentment. That's gone now, pretty much. There's still twinges of resentment and twinges of jealousy. Not so much bitterness, jealousy and resentment, twinges of it. But for a long time, it was consuming. It was really consuming. And... God, I was angry.
Did you notice a pattern in, and by, I don't want to pry too much, but did you notice a pattern in when you were happy or when you was in the state you've just explained? Was there more of a substance use within those two paradigms?
I don't really remember being happy in that whole period. I don't really remember happiness. There was a lot of fear. It was fear and resentment and it was dark, man. It was a dark, you know, the 11 o'clock show started in 1998, September 98. And when did I say I got clean? 2004, I think it's 2014, 2004. And I've been using drugs before then, but that was kind of the key period. There wasn't much joy in there. There was a lot of fear. There was a lot of sadness, a lot of loneliness, a lot of guilt and shame. And the constant was the drugs. I just kept getting more and more and more, and you know, pushing me well outside of my moral boundaries. It's that thing, you know, I'm never gonna do that, never gonna cross that line. And you find yourself crossing that line quite easily and go, right, okay, fuck. Well, I'm never gonna do this, next line. And you just keep crossing those lines of what I thought I was living a life where morals and my morals and my ethics were gone and destroyed and didn't mean anything to me. You know, it was dark, man.
That is the nature of tolerance building, isn't it? It doesn't matter what the substance is. It just matters how you're prepared to go for the next kind of level up.
Yeah.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Have you found any, both publicly and personally, what has been your dealings with stigma?
Stigma around drug addiction?
Yeah, your openness in the way that you're willing to talk about it, and the fact that you are out there saying, look, you know, I've been through this. How has that affected you?
How has it affected me? I was embarrassed when it got in the papers. Didn't get in the papers until after the jungle. And suddenly, for about a year, I was deemed as newsworthy. And stuff... And I talked about being an addict on my radio show before. But as soon as I talked about it after the jungle, it was printed in the newspapers. What the fuck? Which meant that people... You know, let me... tread very carefully around this, that certain relatives of mine who'd been unaware of that because they never listened to my radio show, suddenly it was in the papers, and I had a couple of really awkward conversations with people going, oh, I didn't know you were an addict. Can we chat about this? And I would say, and you know, there's only a couple of people, and they're actually very good about it. And I would explain, look, I've been clean for this amount of time, and this is what I do to maintain my recovery. And it was awkward. I had to a couple of people, a couple of elderly people, I had to explain the situation. I'd always been used to controlling the information. I say it on my radio show, it's a small cult listenership. That's as far as it would go. But suddenly I would say it on the radio show, shit, it's on page 7 of The Sun. You know, God, right, okay. So there was that. Stigma? Not really. Not really. And I decide what I reveal and to whom. Here, I'm very happy to talk about anything, pretty much. on my radio show, if I feel up to it, I'll talk about anything. But it's not public property. My mental health, your physical condition, anybody's story is theirs, right? And they are the only ones that decide when they talk about it and what they say about it. And this whole fascination we've got in the press, on TV, in the papers, you know, the fucking... They don't do it so much now, but you remember those pictures of Gazza, Paul Gascoigne? Paul Gascoigne spotted buying another bottle of vodka. The fuck do I want to see that for? Why do I want to see a man at his lowest ebb killing himself? I don't want to see that. And how do you think printing that picture is going to help him? How do you think humiliating a man who, it would appear, is humiliated enough, how is that going to help? It doesn't help. And, you know, the Mirror printed a story, but I think they printed the story about me getting divorced, and they phoned up my agent to say, we're running this story tomorrow. Would Ian like to do an interview for it? And he told them to fuck off. And they phoned back again and said, we will let Ian say whatever he wants and we'll make it part of our mental health campaign week. And I said, you fucking bastards. How dare you do this as though you're helping me? I don't want the story in the paper that I'm getting divorced. You're going to, if you want to help mental health, don't print it. Don't print it. Because how does that help me? How does that help my ex-wife? How does that help my kids? How does that help her mum and dad? How does that fucking help? And this whole culture, sorry, I'm getting so angry. I'll stop in a minute. This whole culture that the press has, that we have a right to know everything about everybody. Final example. Katie Price is obviously having a really tough time at the moment. I suspect that, from what I have seen, it looks like there might be some kind of addiction issues. There's probably some mental health issues going on. There's certainly some financial issues going on. So how does printing it in the paper every single day, how does that help that poor woman? I know that she's made her living by being in the paper, but give her a break. Let her have some privacy. Let her sort out her life. Let her feed her kids. Leave her alone. Hate it. Sorry, that's my
mind. There's so many points you've hit on there that it's just could not agree with you more on. The fact that, as you said, we use drugs as a folk devil, Gascoigne being a perfect example. Yeah. We've witnessed and I use this in quotation marks, his demise. Mm. And it's hideous. Why do we need to witness that? Is it there as a deterrent for some other people? No, it's not.
It's titillation.
It's salacious headlines, just so that we got something to kind of go, oh, look at this person. Do we feel superior to them? What is it that makes us...
They want a picture of him dead. That's it. They want a picture of him dead. Because then they can go, oh, we lost a hero. No, you fucking... You hounded him. You hound addicts. All this mental health stuff. You hound suicidal people. You hound people that have had nervous breakdowns. You hound them. Leave them alone. It's not even interesting to read. It's not interesting. I think the public wants and deserves more than is. Here's an old rock star who's fallen off the wagon and they're pissed. Have some respect, man.
And also, you touched upon something there that I don't think we've ever really touched upon in this podcast, and it's so crucial, is that, as you said, someone's story is theirs.
Yeah.
It's for them to come out with as and when they feel ready, which is why I always feel quite coy and a sense of responsibility on this podcast, because we're dealing with the most tricky themes possible.
Mm. Adult themes, yeah. Described yeah, as.
We have the little E on iTunes of like explicit. But you're right that I feel, because when we've been discussing this in emails, I'm like, look, whatever time works for you,
yeah.
I'm not here to push you. So, I'm just grateful that there's someone coming forward and putting these points across, because to us, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make sure that people aren't stigmatized, criminalized because of addiction. So when you've got someone like you that is willing to make these points, I'm very conscious of however far you want to go. And I always say, look, I'm not Paxman. I'm not pushing for this. So when you bring that point up that, look, this is someone's story, this is their life, don't just use that as the next headline. Do you reckon we're ever going to get away from that? With the conversations we're having at the moment with mental health and just how affected we all are and how destigmatized it needs to be, is that going to trickle to the press?
No. No. Because it sells. Here's the thing. You've been very generous in your email saying you don't have to answer anything you want. And before you started recording, you said you don't have to answer anything you want. And I can press that stop button if we get to something I don't want, So, But coming here, I am acknowledging that we are going to be talking about drugs and about mental health. So there is kind of an acceptance between the two of us that, yeah, I'm going to talk about that. There might be some stuff I hold back off, but that's the basic premise of the conversation. You know, the press and this Matthew Wright thing, that the premise was not that, you know, they were specifically not going to talk about those things. Will it ever change? No, because it sells, because the people that do these... My radio show, right, we call it The Late Night Alternative. It's me and my friend Catherine, and we don't talk about Brexit, and we don't talk about Trump, and we don't talk about celebrities that are suffering from addiction. We don't do it, right? We don't get very many listeners on my show. You know, we get quite a small audience. But the shows that talk about Brexit and Trump and, you know, celebrities falling off the wagon, they get huge figures. We've had these suicides, you know, the gentleman from Love Island, and there was a woman, I think, from Love Island a couple of years ago, and the Jeremy Kyle guy, and apologies, I can't remember any of their names, so I don't mean any disrespect. But we've had suicides from people having their lives invaded. When I did The Jungle, right, by the way, the psych tests to get in and out of The Jungle, forget it. Because I know what to say to a psychiatrist to get my way. My psych test was done on the phone, and I knew exactly. Have you felt suicidal recently? No. Yeah, I have, yeah. But I'm going to say no. Have you fantasized about taking drugs recently? No. You say all that, and I got in The Jungle. And I went nuts coming out of The Jungle, and I'd had a little bit of TV exposure. I kind of knew what to expect. It was much bigger than I expected, but I kind of knew, and I went nuts. And these poor kids that go on Love Island have got no idea what to expect. They've got no idea of the intrusion they are seemingly opening the doors to. And also, I knew this would happen. It lasted longer than I thought, actually. I had about 8 or 9 months of fame in inverted commas after The Jungle, and then it stopped. Don't get any more work because of it, hardly get recognized in the streets. Stopped. And it was a little bit of a shock, even though I knew it was coming. It was a bit of a shock. But these Love Island kids, and I'm being slightly patronizing, I don't mean to, but these people on Love Island, they don't know that. They think that their life is, I imagine, their life is forever going to be, you know, Instagram and fame and money. Once you've had that check from that show, that's it. Might get a few more quid from doing PAs and things like that. But that's that money. And you've got to pay half of that in tax as well. So you're not as rich as you think you are. And for most of them, 6 months after, that fame is gone. And that's a big thing to accept when you're 22, 23 years old. That fun thing where you're being papped everywhere you go and you're on red carpets, that comes to an end. So it doesn't surprise me that young lad killed himself, you know, took his own life. And, you know, the papers go, oh, this is a real tragedy and this is really sad. And ITV really need to buck up their ideas when it comes to Love Island. But you look at the papers today, it's all going to be, you know, the women and men in Love Island in not many clothes and the latest, oh, such and such fancy such and such, but they were cheating with such. They're playing the same game. So is it ever going to change? I don't think so, unfortunately.
That's a really good point, I think, about fame, because I've always, you know, don't for 1 second think I'm famous, but the small glimpses that I've had of that world, you know, I've had films out that have done well and things like that, and you get to see people that clearly love that environment.
Yeah,
you know,
it's addictive.
You're hanging out with people that are off the telly, off the movie screens. And then all of a sudden, as you said, it stops. Mm. It doesn't necessarily go the way you think it does. If you were to put fame in the same category as drugs, would you say that it is addictive?
Very addictive. My first brush with fame, and I'm doing it in inverted commas with a very small F, with the 11 o'clock show, it scared the shit out of me. And I partly used drugs as an excuse to not really get involved. I didn't go to many showbiz parties, if any. Didn't go to any red carpet events. I would just stay at home and get high. But being recognized in the street, you know, is kind of nice. It's, you know, feeling important. Doing in the run-up to the jungle and for a brief period after the jungle, I felt really important. The run-up to the jungle with the production team, you are treated like a celebrity. They treat you like royalty, right? And it's, you've all got code names and it's all very mysterious and it's all quite intriguing and you're treated like a star. And you go and meet Kevin Ligo, the head of ITV, and you go, you get taken out for expensive lunches and all of this. And you get, you kind of buy into this shit. And then coming out, you know, I had all these meetings with TV people who were saying, we're going to get you back on TV. We've got a great project for you. We've got a documentary idea, got a game show idea for all of this stuff. Of course, it came to nothing, but it's all very flattering. And then it stops and you kind of come crashing down. I expected to come crashing down this time. I kind of knew it was going to happen. But for these younger people, and the turnover is quicker now than it was 20 years ago, I don't think they do. And what do you do? You know, you're 22, you've been on Love Island or you've been on Big Brother. I mean, not quite such an impact these days, but you've been on those programs and you have been made to feel important by the crew, by the fans of the show. And then it goes. It is like a drug. So you will, some people will do anything to keep chasing that high. And some people will debase themselves. You know, we talked about boundaries around drugs. They'll debase themselves to keep getting in the papers. Not all of them. You know, I don't want to generalize too much. But there are some of them that will. Yes, it is very addictive to be, you know, sat next to Brad Pitt at a premiere of a film. It's nice. It's a nice feeling. You feel flattered. You feel attractive. You feel important. You feel sexy. But it's not real.
And that is so true. The people that you sit next to in these events, you know, My parents use me as a name drop for the various people that I've met, right? Because it makes, you know, in their conversations, yeah, that they have with people, it feels, oh, look, he's doing this now, he's met this person.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've always said that, you know, fame, you can see how the trappings, yeah, get you into these places of mental health difficulties and substance use.
And also, being famous doesn't mean you're rich.
Yes, that is so true.
I mean, I got quite a bit of money for the jungle, right? I didn't get as much money as you probably think it is. I certainly got the lowest out of, you know, I was gutted when I found out I got the least out of everybody on there. And my boy said, they should pay you more because you came third. I'm like, yeah, they should have done. I got paid a lot of money, right? But half of that goes on tax, 15% goes to my agent. And then the rest was part of a deposit to a house. It's gone. It went, you know, straight away. I got no idea what they get on Love Island, but They're not rich. People think because you're on telly, because you're at a red carpet event, you must be rich. But I was, you know, I came back from the jungle and I went back to my one room bedsit in Slough that I'd been living in for 18 months that didn't, you know, that was an absolute shithole, that I was scared to park my car there because there were these gangs of kids that were sat outside with knives who would fight and stuff. That's what I went back to. That's the reality of the physical place I went back to. And people would have thought that I was loaded and living in a mansion. It wouldn't work like that.
I can't believe I've got to wrap up with you now because we've been going through it.
Shut up, man. We're just warming up.
I know. This is the thing. Start. When you get someone like you that's just so eloquent
that
and
doesn't
fluent
shut
on it.
Up. Sorry.
What you mean? I need to keep it going. But I'm going to put you on the spot now. So
yes. So, what's my favourite drug? It was...
yeah. Well, you said you like LSD. You said that...
LSD was the most fun. And it feels funny saying that. It feels funny saying that because it feels like in some way I'm condoning. Here's the thing as well. We talk about drugs on the radio show a bit. And I have to, by the rules of Ofcom, I have to say, of course, you know, don't do drugs. But as if some 16-year-old, 25-year-old, 50-year-old listening to me at home with a, you know, gram of coke or a spliff or some hair, whatever, is going to go, fuck, no, oh, that guy on the radio said, they're going to do it. What I want to say is, you know, if you're going to do drugs, as long as you're having fun and you're having a good time, yeah, play safe, man, play safe. I'm an old man. The best advice I can give you is play safe. But I'm not allowed to do that because it then sounds like I'm saying to the listeners, go and do drugs. Here's the thing, people will always do drugs. There is a very strong chance my kids, they're 7 and 9, at some point will do drugs. It's a very, very strong chance. So this is why I think what you're doing is important and what a few other people are doing is important, and it is a few, is acknowledging the reality that for a lot of people, drugs are part of their lives, whether it is addiction and they can't stop, or whether it's just a bit of fun every other weekend. Whatever it is, drugs are a reality for people. And drugs, there's a reason ecstasy is called ecstasy. You know, there's a reason it's got that name. I don't know what the point is I'm trying to make. The point I'm trying to make is that people take drugs, and whatever I say isn't going to stop anybody. If you're doing it, be safe, have fun. There was a big story a couple of months ago, and we did it on the show, about one of the universities, maybe it was Brighton, I'm not sure, gave out advice to new students saying, if you're going to do heroin, have someone with you. And of course, the Daily Mail and the paper, this is outrageous. This is disgusting. And actually, it's a really, really good suggestion. If you're going to do heroin, make sure there's someone with you who can keep an eye on you in case it does turn sour. You know, make that is sensible advice. Instead of saying, don't do heroin, right? Just, if you're going to do it, here are some things that make what can potentially be quite a dangerous pastime a bit safer, right? I'd rather you didn't do it. But if you're going to do it, I certainly don't want you to die. Here's some things that you might want to take into account. Seems perfectly sensible to me.
You've kind of inadvertently answered the question I was going to ask, which was, if you were Prime Minister and you were setting out legislation, and as we've seen in recent times, you've perfectly qualified to do it with everything that's gone on with Michael Gove and everything. But you've set out perfectly, because what we call, what you've just described there, is harm reduction. So if you are, we know that laws don't deter use. We've got all of that on evidence and on record. So if you are to use drugs, this is how to do it safely. Like you said, maybe best you don't, but if you are, here's the way to do it. And is, without getting too personal, and again, you tell me to shut up if you want, but if you mention your children, if you are to educate them, what is your message towards, doesn't have to be just your children, but anybody, what would you say?
Stay off the brown, keep on the white. I don't know. What would my message be? I would really hope, my kids are aware of alcoholism. This is why it's good to talk about this in public, because of Ant from Ant and Dec. Because they were aware of them. They don't watch much sort of telly, but they were aware of Ant and Dec through the jungle. And I can't remember what the conversation was, but they were talking to me about him. And they said, they call getting drunk the drunk for some reason. And they said, is it true that Ant can't stop getting the drunk? And I said, oh, where did you hear about that? And I think a friend had mentioned it at school. And I said, yeah, that is true. He has an illness. I said, do you know what the illness is called? They said, yeah, he's an alcoholic. I said, yeah. And I said, I'll tell you what that means. It means that some people like your granddad can have a drink, two drinks, three drinks, and then they can stop. And then there are some people like Anne who, once they have one drink in them, they can't stop. And I said, it's not a weakness. Don't be ashamed. It's just an illness. He's got an illness. He's got disease, right? And there are ways that he can get better. He needs to go and speak to his doctor and maybe speak to some friends. And there are ways to get better from it, which means he will probably choose to stop drinking forever. We kind of had this, you know, this pretty cool chat. They know that I don't drink, and they've not asked me about it yet. And I'm not going to tell them yet. But they know that I don't drink. And if they do bring it up, I'll say, yeah, this is where they are. I'll talk about being an alcoholic. I won't talk about drugs at this stage necessarily. But when they are old enough, I will tell them, you know, a brief version of my history, and I will talk to them about drugs in the hope that if they ever want to take drugs, they'll come and, you know, maybe I'm sounding like, hey, I'm a cool dad. Come and sit with me and I'll roll you a spliff and well, listen, let me put some Hendrix on and let me tell you some tales. No, I hope they will trust me enough to know that they can come to me and talk about anything and ask anything, and I will give them my honest experience, my honest opinion on it. And then it's up to them to make their own decisions. And as a dad, fuck me, that's hard to say. That is so hard to say. I don't want my kids anywhere near drugs. I don't want my kids taking ecstasy or smoking. I don't want that. It's not my decision. It's their decision. And I have to trust, I have to give them as much information as I can. And then they make the decision that they want to make. You know, it's tough as a dad to say that. You want to protect your babies. And even when they're 20, they'll be my babies.
I think that's a perfect point to end on.
Oh, you want to shut up.
That,
I get it.
Right. That is genuinely the perfect point to end
nice
on.
Nice, because thank you.
I think that is the overriding message, is provide people with the information so they can make their own choices.
Yeah. And not in those, you know, those groovy government ads. Hey, talk to Frank. You know, I know Frank was a great thing. It was a great thing, but it just felt very, you know, you'd be at home smoking a spliff, laughing at those adverts. I think it's really important for parents and schools, parents primarily, to talk honestly and openly about any drug experience that they have had, age appropriate, of course, and be able to be approached by the kids and not be shocked. It's that thing, a kid brings in a pill and you go, what the fuck? That is, you know, you've got to be able to have an honest, open conversation like you're doing with this podcast. I'm Ian Lee. I'm shutting up now. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate your time.
Well, I think you'd agree that was pretty damn powerful. It really helps having someone like Ian in his profile speak about the journey he's been through. It really just does a lot of good. Just so thank you so much, Ian. And I have to do some thank yous as well to all of our team that produced this. It's not just me. There's a big team. It's Tristan and Nikki, the producers, John Cross, the producer as well, and John Harris, that does all of our little social media little bits. Thank you also to Scroobius Pittman, all the Distraction Pieces Network. Thank you to My Name Is Ad for the artwork. And just thank you for listening. Let's keep this conversation going. We need to destigmatise addiction and mental health. Thank you so much. Bye. Behind your barricades. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Behind your barricades. Where true values seldom stray.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.